Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I want to start with a piece from the Avatamsaka. This is the last chapter, Entry into the Realm of Reality. Then Manjushri, having uttered these verses, said to Sodana, "It is good that you think, having set your heart on supreme enlightenment, that you should find out the practice of enlightening beings. It is hard to find beings who set their hearts on supreme enlightenment. It is even harder to find beings who, once they have set their minds on enlightenment, seek the practice of enlightening beings. An enlightening being is to attain certainty through true spiritual friends, spiritual benefactors, for the realization of omniscience. One should indefatigably seek spiritual benefactors and be tireless in seeking spiritual benefactors. One should respectfully follow the appropriate instructions of spiritual benefactors and should carry out the techniques skillfully devised by spiritual benefactors without interruption. South of here is a country called Ramavaranta. There is a mountain there called Sugriva, where a monk named Megashri lives. Go to him and ask how an enlightening being should learn the conduct of enlightening beings and how to apply it, how one is to fulfill, purify, enter into, carry out, follow, keep to, and expand the practice of enlightening beings, and how an enlightening being is to fulfill the sphere of universally good action. That spiritual friend will tell you about the sphere of universally good conduct." In that chapter of the Avatamsaka, that is just the first of many, many, many referrals to spiritual friends that Sudana is sent to one after the other to follow his intention. And the fun thing about the whole thing is that he comes around to where he started at the end. I love it. But that aside, coming into this room, in this time, this reality, not long ago, Thomas gave a student talk about his own process of discernment, trying to figure out if he had a vocation as a monk, or if his life path was leading elsewhere. He very correctly pointed out that his journey, although unique to him, could be used as a metaphor for other discernments. So often, when we are standing at a crossroads, we get confounded by the thought that there is a right way and a wrong way, and no way to tell the difference. When Kyogen and I were living at Shasta Abbey, practicing the monastic style there, we discovered we were in love with each other. Shasta, at that time, was a celibate monastery. The monastery had earlier, and Roshi had earlier, embraced the Japanese concept that a priest could be married. But Shasta did not allow married people to live together on the property. Marriage was still permitted, but discouraged. So we went through a discernment process that went on for 2.5 years. That discernment involved many factors. One basic one that you will all recognize: is this infatuation or a deeper love that can survive decades and difficulties and changes. Also, was this potential commitment to each other greater than, less than, equal to our individual commitments to Buddhism, to Zen, to the priesthood, and to our personal progress on the path? Also, if we were to continue living at the monastery without marrying, what would our relationship be in that case? And if we were to marry and then return to the monastery, what would our relationship be then, being married but living apart? If we were to marry and not return to the monastery full time, how would our relationship to vocation and training evolve? That was a lot to work on. It probably is good that we ended up taking 2.5 years to work on that. And we didn't have mentors, we didn't have spiritual friends, we didn't have Manjushri sending us on to some spiritual benefactor who had been through this path before that could guide us. Roshi was just about the only one who knew of our dilemma, and her input changed radically over time, and not in a straight line. She waffled, flip-flopped, whatever you want to call it. She was not consistent, and sometimes her input was not germane. We had very little time to discuss with each other. What we did have was years of practice, years of turning within, years of clarifying the mind, years of sitting down, shutting up, and listening. So although I'm discussing something personal and particular to me, isn't this something universal? There is always the particularity of our circumstance that is not completely analogous to others. This is why I refuse to tell you what you should do. Marry, divorce, quit your job, have a child, have an operation, move, don't move, get a tattoo, remove the tattoo. Not my business, not my path. Not my decision to make. But what I will tell you is sit still and listen. I hope that the time you spend in this zendo is teaching you not to be afraid of silence. In that silence, there is an opportunity for your interior wisdom, your Buddha nature, to fill your heart. Peace, joy, compassion, friendliness, these things are in there somewhere. One way of expressing the desire for enlightenment is to wish to manifest the wisdom of our Buddha nature. Nyogen Senzaki is one of our spiritual benefactors. He's respected all over the United States as a spiritual benefactor, a guy who spent decades practicing alone, clarifying his own mind and not speaking. And he did that because his dedication to the practice was so intense, but he also did it because he was an orphan. He was literally orphaned as a child, but he was orphaned again by his teacher, Soen Shaku, who left him in the United States without any visible means of support, either monetary, physical, or spiritual, except what he carried with him. And with all of that, he became a fantastic teacher. So in one of his Dharma talks, he says, Dr. Frank Crane, a popular American writer, once said, when we have a task we want to accomplish, we form a mind concept of the thing desired. That is called an ideal. Now, we Buddhists have our ideal, which is none other than the accomplishment itself. Dr. Crane also said, have an ideal of the kind of man you want to be and try to express that in your everyday life, only so you can grow day by day and achieve contentment. You may never reach your ideal. It may keep floating on and on before you. The sailor never reaches the North Star, yet without a North Star, he would never come to port. That was Dr. Crane's ideal. Mine is a little different from his North Star. It is all very well to put an image of your ideal in front of you, but if you cannot reach it, what is the use of deceiving and tantalizing yourself with it? Christians never expect themselves to become God, and they think Buddhists also should not think to become Buddha, if Buddha is another name for God. On the contrary, we Buddhists aim to become Buddhas, not in heaven or paradise or in the lotus land of hereafter, but in this actual everyday life in our own living world. Buddha is not a concept. It is our own mind, an achievement of our own experience. Finding the methods, the practices, the teachings, the community, the support for our progress toward becoming a Buddha in this life, or even some future life. This is another discernment process. Most of us do this fairly naturally, organically, feeling our way forward toward those methods, practices, teachings, communities, and forms of support that give us hope and encouragement. Finding those things that invite our trust. But the path is never a straight line. No matter how deeply we commit, we are likely to find times or circumstances when great fear or anger or doubt arise. In fact, it is often in proportion to the intensity of our commitment that the fear, the anger, the doubt, and the resistance arise. Roshi used to talk about the path to the monastery, the path toward ordination. She said, it's just amazing how many people fall in love on the way to the monastery. Going this way, going this way. Oop! Something else to do. Excuse me. So when the resistance arises, when the fear, the anger, the doubt arise, then what? Cut and run? Repress, deny, argue, complain, blame, collapse in despair, distract and avoid, binge eat, binge drink, binge TV watch, or sit still and listen to the fear, the anger, the doubt. Sit still and feel the feelings. Even our delusions usually have some kernel of truth. If we can be patient, it may become clear. I won't promise, but I say it happens. And even if it does not become clear in a timely and useful way, the practice of sitting still and listening when we are agitated gives us an opportunity to let the agitation subside and maybe avoid doing something rash. It can happen as you sit still and listen. It occurs to you, a thought, a plan, an interpretation of circumstances. And I'm going to suggest that you trust it conditionally. You are probably on the right track. But just in case, what would it cost you to run it by somebody else? Some elder, some peer, some spiritual benefactor, some spiritual friend you can trust. I heard a rumor a couple nights ago that a politician, when asked about his plans to hire consultants and advisors, pointed to his own head as the only advisor he would need. If true, that rumor points to someone Nyogen Senzaki would say is lacking in treasure. It's another one of his Dharma talks called Seven Treasures. Bodhisattvas, the way he addressed his students. Bodhisattvas, this evening I will tell you about the seven treasures described in the Saddharma Pundarika Sutra. In the time of the Buddha Shakyamuni, people considered gold, silver, lapis lazuli, agate, corals, amber, and pearls to be the seven treasures. Those were costly and dear to the people of India, the same as diamonds, platinum, radium, and others are to us in the modern age. Buddha Shakyamuni compared the seven treasures of materialistic wealth to the same number of spiritual treasures. According to Chiki, the founder of the Tendai school of China, the seven spiritual treasures are as follows: the treasure of faith, the treasure of persistence, the treasure of listening, the treasure of humility, the treasure of precepts, the treasure of self-surrender, the treasure of meditation and wisdom. Let us contemplate these seven treasures. There is a gatha expressing the Buddhist faith. D.T. Suzuki's translation reads, "The Buddha body fills the world, universally immanent in all things. It manifests wherever and whenever conditions are mature, though it never leaves the seat of Bodhi." However much money you have, no matter how grand your house or luxurious your clothes, if you have a shortage of these seven treasures, you are flirting with poverty. To trust only one's own ideas, thoughts, plans, worldview, is to be lacking in listening, to be lacking in humility, to be lacking in self-surrender. But to trust only what others tell you, to only believe what you read in books, is to be lacking in faith, is to be lacking in meditation and wisdom. And to decide that you are too flawed to ever manifest the wisdom of a Buddha is to be lacking not just in faith, but in perseverance. Do not let fatigue and frustration paralyze you. Not in your quest for the mind of a bodhisattva, not in your quest for clarity in your particular human life path, Buddha nature does not desert you. The seven treasures are close to hand. The principle of diversity is declared in the second line of the Gatha, the one that I read you before, universally immanent in all things. The Buddha body, the essence of existence, though absolutely one in itself, allows itself to be diversified as the lilies of the field, as the fowls of the air, as the creatures of the water, or as the inhabitants of the woods, for it is in the inherent nature of the Buddha body that it individualizes itself in the manifoldness of the phenomenal world. It does not stand alone outside particular existences, but abides in them, animates them, and makes them move freely. By thus abandoning its absolute transcendentality, it has subjected itself to certain conditions such as space, time, and causation. Its essence is infinite, but its manifestations are finite and limited. Therefore, the Buddha body has to wait to express itself in this relative world until all the necessary conditions are matured. This creation, so-called, is no more than a manifestation of the self-limiting Buddha body. Persistence is key. As we are moving toward the time and the space, the place for that maturity, there are times of doubt. There are times of frustration. But persisting is one of the treasures. And what is decorated, what is illuminated, what is manifest is the particularity of your human life that is the individuation of the Buddha body unfolding in the phenomenal world. So as you move through a discernment process in finding your way toward complete enlightenment, as you do a discernment process trying to figure out if you should move to Timbuktu, if you do a discernment process trying to decide what your vocation truly is, be patient, be trusting, and be full of faith that inside and outside there are spiritual friends that speak softly and guide well. Short talk today.
Hi, thanks for the talk. So I'm not meaning this question to be clever or tricky or anything, but I'm trying to reconcile some of the stuff you were saying about meditation with the whole, you know, thinking about not thinking versus what you were saying, you know, sort of concentrating on what your thoughts are, and that sort of spectrum between. So,
well. When you come in here and sit on the cushion and stare at the wall, making your best effort to not think is a really good plan. And what I'm talking about with the silence, there are a lot of Christian writers that say a problem with a lot of people's approach to prayer is they keep talking and they don't listen enough, and that, you know, that stands true for Buddhists too. A lot of times we sit down and we stare at the wall and all we're doing is running the same storylines we've been doing all day long. So making an effort to be silent externally and internally as much as possible is a good effort. But what I'm talking about with the discernment process, yeah, it involves a certain amount of discursive thought, but I'm saying that if you want that inner wisdom to emerge, you're going to have to shut up at some point. So they're not all that different, really.
Yeah, this is more of a trivial observation, but I think it's true not just of the more profound insights, but even just when you're at work, I've noticed, you know, if you're trying to figure out a technical problem, a lot of times, if it's a really hard one, what you need to do is at some point just give up and, you know, maybe in a few hours or a few days, the answer will, you know, comes to you in the shower or mm-hmm. something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I bet everybody has had the same experience. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe what you're talking about is developing faith that that is important and a real thing.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a little different when you're dealing with the kind of mind lockup you get into with a technical problem that doesn't resolve itself. But it's analogous. It is similar.
Could you say a little more about faith and how do you recognize it when you see it? And maybe how is it related to trust?
It's the same thing. In my vocabulary, faith and trust are the same thing. And one of the fun things about Buddhism in the modern age is that you can have complete faith and complete trust without having a recognizable object for it. If you want an object, you can talk about faith in the practice or faith in the process. And for some of us, it moves around. And so some modern Buddhists would jump down my throat for saying this, but sometimes my faith has a personality. It's, I feel Kanzan interfering in my life in a really good way, and, who am I to argue with that? And yet, that's not where my faith resides. My faith is more free-floating than that, and yet it's also more persistent. Does that talk to your question at all? Okay.
So I was noticing that you talk about the balance, I think, between listening to other people and listening to your own voice.
Yeah.
And is there a way that you can... I already know the answer to this, actually. Can tell where you should put your effort or where that balance lies?
I think that for the people in this room, three-quarters or seven-eighths of it is on finding that wisdom inside. And the checking with others is a part of your safety net, because self-deception is so slippery. And so it's important that there be enough humility to say, this is right, I feel the rightness of this, but I'm gonna check just in case. Because we can get seriously self-deluded. And that has repercussions. But just because somebody else says, no, you're wrong, that's also not definitive.
And I think sometimes I've heard it said that when someone says, no, you're wrong, suddenly then you know for sure that you're right. It happens. It can clarify things.
It helps to clarify. Right. Yeah.
Earlier in your talk, you said something about trust in the way I heard it was like you're looking around and you're finding something to have trust in. And what I heard there was like a picking and choosing of like which is not a bad thing, but the way I look at that sometimes, if you can't have faith in everything, that there's something wrong. And so there's like me, like, because trust is certainly an issue for me. And so if I pick and choose, I can have trust in this and trust in that and trust in this, but not that, that, or that. There's something not wrong there, but there's something that just doesn't match up. But yet in a way, you're like, okay, this is really something I feel comfortable with and I can trust, and that just isn't. It's both there.
So what you're describing, I would say, is undeveloped trust. That when it is picking and choosing, there is not a lot of trust there, and so you're managing it. I'll invest an ounce of trust in this and another thing because I only have so much to apply. But as it grows, it fills in more space and time.
I hear that. There was a question underneath there that I'm still struggling with.
Do you have an answer to the question that was underneath? Can you clarify the question that was underneath?
But it did sound like it was okay to look around a little bit and, like, and say, okay, this I can trust and that I can't, and that feels comfortable. But yet there is a problem in that, and that you can't... just that discerning, do I have trust in this and trust in that, is problematic. Because, like I say, it's not that I don't have... there's not a good reason why I don't have trust in this. It's just I don't... like, then it falls into that area, I don't have enough trust, and I can't trust this. But it seems like there is a place where you can say, look, okay, yes, I trust this. I trust this a lot. This, not so much. And so there is a bit of a picking and choosing there that is different from I don't have a lot of trust. That certainly is also my issue, but...
You know the practice that we do with the Metta Sutra about finding that feeling of safety and well-being inside and then spread it out as far as you honestly can. And then you come back to the practice again and you still, you know, it only goes as far as the edge of my zabuton and the rest of you are on your own. But but over time, it gets to expand a few feet this way and a few feet this way, and you grow the capacity to find that sense of well-being and start extending it to fluffy bunnies and you know, other things that are safe for you to extend that to. And it's only much later, after a long time of practice, that you are able to extend that well-wishing to someone who is not wishing you well. So I'm saying that this is analogous to trust and faith, is that, yeah, you pick and choose to the extent that, okay, I can only trust this far and no further. And it's just, you know, making myself go any further than that is just falling off a cliff for no good reason. But the practice is to expand that further.
When you're working through a process of discernment or helping somebody else work through one, do you find yourself falling back on some favorite principles, some guiding principles, maybe like, is this coming from a compassionate place or will it bring wholesome karma into the world? Do you find yourself favoring certain principles to help you?
One of the things that I tend to do is start working with hypotheticals. So I will take take the extreme position of, you know, if they're struggling between three positions, I will imagine that, you know, okay, they're talking about moving to Idaho. Okay, what if we talk about moving to Siberia? Okay, and they're talking about, you know, some other life choice, and I will take an extreme version of that and get them to feel interiorly what is the reaction to that as a way of getting them to start modulating their thought patterns and their reactivity to the different options. I think if you get too idealistic and hypothetical about our shared ideals about compassion and good for the world, and you're moving people into a headier, more cerebral approach to the problem, and you know if it's a life-changing decision that is being made, you don't want to be making that totally from your headspace. You need to have your whole heart and body invested in that change of life situation.
So, the concept of faith and trust is something that I really struggle with, even before Buddhism, long before Buddhism. My experience has been that the more I look for something to trust, and by trust and faith, I sort of finding something fixed, finding something that can be mm-hmm. counted on, whether externally or internally. The more I look for that, the less I see it, the less I find it. Mm-hmm. And so can you just talk a little bit more about what you mean by faith and trust and its importance on the path and where we can look for it?
Well, when I was struggling with this early on in my Buddhist practice, a teacher that wasn't very skilled in a lot of ways gave me one instruction that I found useful. And he said, when I get up in the night, to swing my feet over the side of the bed in a dark room where I can't see the floor, and stand up, trusting that the floor is going to be underneath my feet and support me, all the way to the bathroom. And that is not a very big thing, but it is something we expect and rely on and don't give it very much credit. But if there is nothing to rely on, that floor could be taken away. Gravity could be taken away. Air could be taken away. So if you can start moving toward appreciation, don't try to invent trust. Don't try to invent faith, but just start appreciating whatever support seems to be dependable. I think faith and trust will grow out of that. It's a matter of turning toward something manageable but positive.
Thank you.
I've seen and I've experienced in myself this process of discernment, finally coming to a decision, acting on it, and then it's almost incomplete because then there's a lot of time spent looking back and what if, and not exactly regretting but wondering. And it seems to me like a complete discernment process, you just move forward. That there isn't something left behind of wondering what if. Can you say anything?
I'm not sure that we get out of jail free card, even if you've done a really good job on your discernment. There is always room for doubt and confusion and second guessing. I mean, you can buy your ideal house and move all your ideal furniture in and still have buyer's remorse. No?
Thank you. You know, as everybody's been commenting and questioning, I couldn't help but review, you know, the last couple decades of my life and the decisions that I've made, and there's small ones and there's big ones. And it seems like the bigger the decision, the less I'm involved and have been for a long time. Those kinds of decisions just seem to make themselves. And I don't know how it happens. It's just one day the decision is made.
And how do you feel about that?
I'm happy with that.
Okay.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to do it a different way.
Well, one thing I said in my talk is that a lot of these decisions we do organically.
Right.
Fairly naturally. And sometimes we don't have to get all cerebral about it because that internal gyroscope is keeping us oriented to where we need to go.
Right.
So if you don't have any regrets, don't have any regrets.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely a feeling of ease and comfort that arises from that decision sort of opening and, you know, unfolding on its own.
Thank you all.